The next film we're going to talk about is The Hurt Locker, which may be my favorite film of the year. This is a great action film, brings up a lot of interesting issues related to war. Father Jim, why don't you weigh in?
Yeah, I thought it was, frankly, the best movie of the year. I found it particularly interesting because it was so unexpected. It's not structured like most movies that you've seen. There's no sort of definite beginning, middle, and end. It's very hard to predict. It's not formulaic. I found as a movie it worked very well in that way, but also as just an entree into the chaos of what it must be like. I have no experience in wartime. I found it very provocative. I thought the characters were terrific. The writing was great. It was, as you say, an action film. A little gory, not too gory, but very unexpected, and it really kept me guessing. So I just thought it was terrific. And I didn't go into the movie theater expecting very much, so it was all the more exciting when I saw it.
Hurt Locker, to me, actually, I know this analogy probably will fall flat on some levels, but it reminded me a few years ago when Sideways was nominated for one of the best pictures. Another good movie that I'm kind of a little bit surprised that it's gotten the amount of attention it did. I will say that I had heard so much about the Hurt Locker before I saw it that it could have perhaps stoked the fire a little too hot for me. I liked the movie. I thought the main character was so opaque that I honestly felt it to be a little bit hard to involve myself in. It's certainly powerful and it's certainly jarring and emotionally. It's an emotional kind of ride basically, you know, descent that's difficult. So it's there's some real power to it. But I wouldn't say it's a movie that I found bowled me over that was to me worthy of best movie. Although I know it might win because I know it's won other awards.
Well, this is Jeremy Renner who plays the main character. He's basically heading this team that detonates IEDs. So they go out of these very tense situations where they're called out to try to explode these devices. One of the questions that has come up in related to this film is it's sort of an apolitical look at the Iraq War, and for that reason maybe has become a little more popular than, say, a film like The Messenger with Woody Harrelson, which and other films, documentaries about Iraq. Do you think a film like this about Iraq can engage the war in a way that is not at all political, that doesn't get into the questions of whether we should be there or not?
You know, my sense is that it in fact, as you were saying, is apolitical, and it does not engage, you know, why are we there? And you can look at these people as heroes. They don't really talk about why they're there, as in most war movies. Sometimes the characters are sort of mouthpieces for the writer or the director's views. But I just thought they were there to do a job. I remember reading, I read several books on wartime, and, you know, they say that when soldiers are there, their primary mission is A, to get home, and B, to protect people, you know, with them in the foxhole. So that was my sense, that it was a very sort of immediate sort of goals for them. You know, to respond to, I thought Bill made a good point. The character is very opaque, and I think that can distance you. But I also thought, in a way, it made him more realistic. You know, I mean, he was, like, you know, many people, sort of hard to figure out. I thought the ending, which I won't give away, was interesting. But you know, it was frustrating when I was watching it, but I sort of thought, you know, like, this is actually a good sort of entree into someone's very real personality, you know?
And I think, I mean, that's a great point to me, and it kind of reminded me of an op-ed you folks did a few years ago. Jim Conroy, Jesuit, who's the head of the Jesuit Collaborative up in Boston, wrote an article about his time in Vietnam and going back, and he made the parallel, and I spoke to him recently about this, that folks coming back from Afghanistan and Iraq are going to be going through a lot of what his Vietnam veteran friends went through, and we're not really prepared for it. And there's been a spate of movies and documentaries about veterans coming back, dealing with some serious, obvious, you know, traumatic stress issues. And Hurt Locker, if anything, is sort of speaks to that reality of I think a reality that's going to be dawning more and more on Americans in the next few years. So it was actually, in that sense, I think it does speak about the war in a very powerful, non-political way, a very human way.
Yeah, although, I mean, you could make the argument that it is, in a way, a political argument that she's making, that if, just showing you the effects of war on this one individual who they keep getting sent back into the same zone.
Right.
These multiple tours of duty.
That's a good point. Sort of a general anti-war.
Yeah. Well, just that at least the way we're going about fighting wars right now is that we're putting too much we're placing too much of a burden on these volunteer soldiers.
Same mm-hmm. people. No, that's a good point. Yeah, but you don't get the sense that it's my feeling was you don't get the sense when you're watching it that it's sort of agit prop. You know.
No.
That
oh no, not at all.
You know, but which I appreciate it, and I find Catherine Bigelow just a terrific director. I find her very sort of unusual, and she takes kind of chances in terms of her cinematography and her framing. I could really see her
winning the best director, mm-hmm. and maybe not. Getting the best picture, maybe right. Avatar will get it.
And she'd be the first woman.
You really think she'll beat out her ex-husband, James
I'd love to see it, but yeah.
I think there's a lot of sentiment from what I've read about giving it to a woman.
They've never given it to a woman before. Yeah. I think, yeah.
And how and many James, times? And James Cameron's already gotten it for Titanic. Right. He's king of the world.
What were her earlier movies?
She did Point Break.
Point Break.
And I think Blue Steel.
Most of the action films.
Yeah. Wasn't that a Zoolander movie?
Blue Steel. And I think she did the one with Jamie Lee Curtis and Ron Silver. If that's maybe wrong, but she definitely did Point Break.
Point Break,
it's a lot of fun.
Well, we'll switch to another action movie here, Inglourious Basterds, which is kind of a revenge fantasy for Jews because it's about this crew of Nazi killers that go out into the World War II theater to literally hunt down and scalp Nazis. Now, obviously, this is a work of fiction. This is not based on any kind of real history. Bill, were you surprised this was included in the top 10?
I think and I think with the 10 slate, category, the 10 slate nominees, it includes movies like this that would not generally, I think, in my mind, be included. I think Quentin Tarantino is an amazing stylist. I thought Pulp Fiction was a seminal film back in 1994. Inglourious Basterds was another serving to me, albeit in a more historical context of the cartoon / comic book style / film student geek style that Tarantino has become so well known for. So I'm kind of amazed it's in a Best Picture category. I mean, I think there were some good performances, including the German officer whose name I can't remember off the top of my head.
Christopher Waltz does a great job.
It's terrific.
And the story is interesting, but again, like a lot of his movies, they don't for me amount to much more than just a great ride.
Yes, and for me, I hadn't seen a Quentin Tarantino film in a while. I forgot how violent they could be, and it was a little much at the end.
You don't like scalpings in your movies.
Yeah.
But also just this, I mean, I won't give it away, but this like inferno at the end where people are just dying left and right and being, it was just a little too much for me.
I was kind of surprised it was on the Best Picture list as well. I mean, I thought that, I agree with you, Bill, that Quentin Tarantino, I think, is brilliant at times. I like True Romance and Pulp Fiction. I wasn't as crazy about Reservoir Dogs because it was so violent, but I thought there's this the German officer Christopher Waltz. There's this great opening scene where he's interrogating someone in a farmhouse. There's this wonderful sort of focus on a glass of milk that reminded me of the glass of milk in Notorious, with Cary Grant and Ingrid Bergman.
Ah, good reference.
And thank you. And I'm assuming that's what he's sort of referring to too. But and then the rest of the movie I thought was kind of some of the parts of the movie were kind of cartoonish. I mean, the scalping, I thought, give me a break. I don't want to see scalpings. Some of the stuff with Joseph Goebbels, and I mean, that was interesting. But it was almost as if I'm waiting for Quentin Tarantino to break out of the sort of references to different directors and just do something straight like he did in the first scene. If he had sort of was able, if he were able to sustain that, shall we say, more serious way of making films, I would have liked to have seen a movie like that because he's really clever. And I just wish that he would sort of move past some of those, what I think is somewhat gimmicky. I mean, listen, he on a bad day is better than 95% of most directors on good days.
Although that first scene, which was a very powerful scene, you're right, is also a reference, though.
True.
What you just said, right. It's just a reference from a different reservoir and library than the Kung Flu and Blaxploitation.
Yeah.
Other kind of comic booky movies, he's clearly very very capable, and you just wonder if the content of some of the ideas or substance is not.
I also think part of it was like the styles of so many of those segments were, or the styles of many of the segments were so jarring and different. If it had sustained that, if it had sustained one sort of feeling through the whole movie, it might have been a little less disjointed for me.
But I think Bill's right that there is more highbrow film references in this film than his normal. Like there's a woman character who runs a theater, and they're doing like these retrospectives of these obscure German directors and he's showing off a little bit.
Yeah, he is, and also
he's
like
not going to bring Jackie Brown in, movie to kick some butt.
But that raises an interesting question too. These directors who were these enormous film buffs, can it become debilitating after a while when like you're just there's so many influences? Can you find your own voice? I just bring this up because Scorsese's latest movie, which just came out last week, Shutter Island. has gotten kind of roundly panned, and largely because they feel like it's too much of an homage to other directors.
Well, you know, it's funny. I saw a movie this week, and this is not the time to discuss it, called Lords by a Austrian director. And very briefly, she has a very fresh style. She's not, I mean, as far as I can see, she's not referring to anybody. She's not sort of making little gimmicks. It's just a very straightforward style. And I thought, you know, I appreciate that. It's a good eye that she has. And I kind of like that better than this kind of sort of grab bag. I mean, Alfred Hitchcock did not need to sort of refer to too many other directors.
Right, right. He had his own style.
It wasn't the same canon of directors.
It's true. It's true.
And but you're right. It's like the web where everything becomes built upon other people's, and mm-hmm. you start seeing the lineage. But I think with somebody like with Tarantino, the lineage becomes very, very obvious sometimes.
Mm-hmm. And feels like it weighs it down a little bit.
Yeah,
I mean,
I haven't seen the, is it the Ghostwriter, this new Roman Polanski? But some of the reviews have said that he is able to kind of appropriate these sources, but also make them his own in a way that, at least in comparison to Shutter Island, Scorsese does.
It's like that Woody Allen line from Stardust Memories where someone comes up and says, did you mean for that scene to be an homage to Alfred Hitchcock? And he said, no, I stole it.
Well, we'll transition to a film which I think has a unique style, which is Precious. The full title is Precious, based on the novel Push
by Sapphire.
By Sapphire, because there was another film out there called Push. Was that correct? Yes. Am I the only one who's seen this film?
Yes. So if we want to pass,
well, why don't we?
In my defense, I will say that I've seen and read a little bit about the film, and it's something I do want to see. But I will, you know, openly admit that it was looked so brutal to watch, and I was not in the mood. In sort of over these darkened winter months to sort of heap on what seemed to be a very powerful movie and also just a very, very emotionally difficult movie to watch. Everything I've heard about has been really powerful and profound and great, and I think it's really neat that the actresses, Monique and the young woman who plays Precious, right?
Gabori Sidibe,
they're getting a lot of attention. You know, these are not your typical actress, you know, figures. Physically don't look, and yet they look like a lot of people we see walking down the street. Yeah, I will see the movie, so apologies to readers.
No, that's all right. I think I'm the only one who's seen it.
Well, Tim, can I ask you a few
questions?
You
ask me questions?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most salient question, or the one that's been bandied about most in the media, is this question of, is it just sort of, in a sense, playing to stereotypes of African-Americans, the urban poor, or does it, in fact, show this, in a sense, triumph of the spirit of Precious, of the young woman. And it's funny, you know, you have Oprah Winfrey and what was the director's name?
Lee Danielson.
Both of them, yeah, go Philly. both of them African-Americans. And so I find that a very interesting question and really passionate editorials and commentary on both sides of those. So what did you think?
Well, I would say that I don't think a white director could have made this film because I don't think it would have been seen as racist because it is dealing with stereotypes specifically that kind of Reagan era, this takes place in the 80s, like the Reagan era, quote unquote, welfare queen, which is essentially what Precious's mother, who's played by Monique, is. I mean, she's a woman living at home, you know, taking in welfare payments for not, and she's not working. She's supposedly taking care of a child she's really not taking care of. So, and she's this awful figure who, you know, she basically, I mean, this is not giving anything away, but Precious is abused as a child sexually. She gives birth to two children by her own father. And Monique character essentially lets this happen. And there is this monologue she has in the end where she tries to justify it in some way, or at least explain it. That is really, I think it's the reason why Monique will get the Oscar. It is kind of a tour de force that she's able to. I think for that scene alone, it's worth seeing because it gives you this window into something that you prefer to look away and not look at this kind of mentality, you know, this what can give rise to this terrible kind of abuse, but to kind of see how it can develop and how insidious it can be, it was very eye-opening.
Well, what do you think? I mean, when you read those editorials and you hear the commentary, is it surprising you?
No, I mean, I don't think, I'm not surprised that this debate has come up, but as people responded, including Sapphire, I believe, in the pages of the New York Times, saying, you know, this problem of sexual abuse is not limited to the African-American community, and that people like Precious come from all races and backgrounds, and that's one of the things she was trying to deal with, was the problem of sexual abuse. She sets the story within this community, but it's not limited to that community.
And also, as Bill was saying, I think the idea of, once again, I haven't seen it either, the idea of focusing on that sort of slice of life that most people don't see. I found that there was an interview with, I think it's Gabori Sidibe, you say, and she was saying, you know, I pass by women like Precious every day. And it reminded me a little bit about Katrina And Haiti, you know, sort of suddenly we know that, or at least the media sort of reveals to us, quote unquote, that there are poor people. And I think any sort of film that encourages people who are not in touch with that reality to reflect on it more deeply, because, you know, it sounds like from what you're describing, it is, you know, more or less a tragedy, you know, her circumstances.
I think that's exactly right. I think it's a window onto the life of the poor.
Yeah.
And something the urban poor, the African-American poor from the 80s, I mean, obviously it's not contemporary, but... Yeah, I think that's another reason to see it, because it's something, you're right, that, you know, we see these news reports about Katrina, but this gives you, I mean, in a way that sometimes fiction can only do, it can bring you into a situation and give you this window onto these, you know, terrible, you know, these lives that in a lot of ways, Precious is coming from this, you know, the terrible history of abuse, and she's trying to emerge from it and, you know, trying to make something of her life and try to kind of cut that, get that part away. And I didn't come out of the movie seriously depressed. Because it does end on a note where, as I said, I mean, the character of Precious does try to emerge from this, and she doesn't wind up in the downward spiral that can too often happen to people who are victims of abuse. Is that it just kind of starts over again, and that there's no
remember
sign
the
of
movie
that.
Kids a number of years
oh,
ago?
Oh, I never saw that. That's another movie.
But an example that's the way I feel about this movie. It's like I saw that movie and I remember being stunned and just really, it's a kind of a despair kind of moment when you see it, and that means the filmmaker's done something right there, but it's. Also something you have to realize you can only put yourself...
Right, no, but I don't think... I didn't come out, you know, with any kind of feeling of despair.
Really?
I definitely
maybe you're
so
hard-hearted, Tim.
Well, we can switch now to a serious man. Speaking of despair, the Coen brothers have brought us another bleak portrayal, although also a deeply comic portrayal of Jewish life in suburban Minnesota. I think we've all seen this one. No, Father
James. No, this is... You're in my I Have Not Seen duo... Of
but
movies.
We can talk about it. Bill, as you know, you and I are both Irish Catholics. Were you able to kind of access this movie, even though there was a lot of Jewish humor in it?
Yeah, I really loved it. And I'll go, you know, going on the record, I think last year here that I have the Coen brothers, I think, are great technicians and great filmmakers on one level that, except for the Big Lebowski and maybe early movies, leave me completely empty at the end of them in the sense of I don't really remember them much. They seem to have a grand, elaborate joke on the human condition.
I think you said this about No Country for Old Men.
Really? Yeah, I think they're, again, great filmmakers, very smart people whose films I don't end up caring about much at the end. Whereas I'd say Serious Man surprised me, very pleasantly surprised me in their dealing with a moral universe to some degree and an interest in that. It was funny, and I know friends who are Jewish loved it because it's 1960s, early 60s, Minnesota Jewish family, sort of very Hebrew school. It was just really well done, and you know, while the ending is sufficiently existential for the Coens, I would say that they deal with it's a powerful movie. I liked it a lot. I really enjoyed it.
Well, the question that came up in our review, I believe it's John Anderson who reviewed it. Some of his colleagues in the film criticism industry thought that. And they were non-Jewish. You know, if I was Jewish, I would consider this almost anti-Semitic because of this brutal portrayal of Sunday. I'm saying Sunday school, but Hebrew school life, and you know, this kind of closed society. But we were talking about this earlier. I didn't feel that way coming out of it. It didn't strike me as anti-Jewish. I mean, maybe because I've seen enough films about you know the Jewish. Suffocating life of Irish Catholics that it's like, well, you know, this is part of the deal when you come up from a culture like that, it was to me there was a lot of love put into it because why spend the time looking at it if you just want to totally you know trash it?
Well, it's also the analog to the Precious situation where you have African American filmmakers making a slice of life movie about that experience, and here you have two Jewish filmmakers making you know I assume you know somewhat based on their upbringing.
Yes, that's definitely
they're Minnesotans, right?
Right, and.
It's also interesting that, I mean, Bill, you were saying you liked it more than some of their other movies, and yet, ironically, I mean, it's not doing as well as something like Fargo or, I mean, even like Raising Arizona. Or it's interesting, I mean, because it's gotten a lot of great reviews, but, I mean, I remember after we reviewed it, it sort of fell off. I mean, this was not a sort of result of our review, but after we reviewed it, it sort of fell off the map, and I didn't hear too many people talking about
it. America Pan comes through. That's right. You're dead in the water.
He liked it. He liked it, so...
I think if you're dealing with a film that deals in a lot of cultural, I mean, middle America, I don't see. Right.
This is a narrow group that
middle American Jewish 1960s. Yeah, it's fairly narrow casting.
But yeah, no. That said, I don't think anybody should be afraid to not see it, because it is a very Jewish movie. In the same way that a Jewish person seeing a movie about Italian or Irish Catholics in America could also see it and gain something from it. There's something very universal in these kids' desire and the main character's marriage and struggle with relationship and ultimately with God and meaning and references the Jefferson Airplane throughout, which I thought was...
Yeah, well, it starts essentially with Is It Somebody to Love, the song.
No, one of the scenes that John Anderson, our reviewer, talked about was the scene at the beginning, which I found fascinating, the shtetl. There's sort of a right. little vignette. Now, what happens with that? There's a...
Yeah, Bill...
It's like a fable old wives' tale about some sort of devil character that would exist in... it's a joke. It's like a mm-hmm. it's like a dark joke, mm-hmm. as I recall. And you're right, it is completely in a different tone as the rest mm-hmm. of the movie. But this is the Coen brothers,
yeah.
and they do this.
Well, it's similar to Tarantino in a sense.
Right, yeah, very much so.
That's true. I had almost forgotten about the scene, because it's so different from what comes after.
Different. Yeah,
yeah. yeah it almost looks like a... Almost like an SNL sketch.
Yeah, it's almost like a little short that they really put at the beginning of the film. Yeah.
That sets up this whole... I forget the name, but there's some sort of Yiddish term, I think, for...
Dibbuk.
Oh, Dibbuk.
Dibbuk, that's right. Dibbuk, yeah.
So I'm sure there's
like
some
living dead or
something we're not getting there. But also the ending. I mean, we were saying before we should have a podcast where we just talk about the ending of these films. But there is...
Spoiler
we
podcast.
Can say it's like a... biblical type episode that happens mm-hmm. at the end. And
absolutely.
Is it like Avatar? Do they destroy a big tree?
Yeah,
or
blue
anything?
People come out of nowhere mm-hmm. and these blue, huge Jewish mm-hmm. people from Minnesota take over the movie. It's a little bit inconsistent with the rest of the film, but hey, I give them a lot of leeway. They're the Coen brothers.
Yes. Yeah, they're having some fun.
I kid.
Well, we're almost there. We're in the home stretch here. We're going to transition to Up, which Jim has claimed to see 5 times.
Five times.
So I'm going to...
Up.
With somebody with 2 young nephews, so I can understand that.
Yes, but well, we've
really
seen
it 5 times?
Yeah, I saw it once in the theater, once with a friend of mine who hadn't seen it, and 3 times with my nephews.
So you like it that time. Much?
I don't know if I would have seen it on my own 5 times. I thought it's a great movie. I thought there is a... One of the things I'd like to point out to people who haven't seen it, I mean, people know it's the story of an old man who wants to go to, I think it's South America, where he attaches his house to balloons. They float there. They have misadventures. Lessons are learned, but one of the things that happens is a little kid tags along, and they learn from each other and have this very tender relationship. At the beginning of the movie, there is a little sort of mini movie, a vignette that sort of chronicles how the old man became not only a widower but somewhat bitter and isolated, and it's him meeting a young girl, falling in love, getting married, sort of spending a life with her. In 5 minutes, silently, with basically just sort of montages of still photos and animation, they tell the story of a life in a beautiful way. And I read a review, and I agree with this, that those 5 minutes in Up, the first 5 or 10 minutes, are better than most movies these days.
Oh, my gosh.
And really was quite moving. I saw with my nephews, and they were saying, this is really sad, But the rest of the movie, for me, is also a great parable about a love, and to use some Ignatian terminology, detachment. A lot of it is about being attached to things, to plans, to people. What is it good to be attached to? What is it good to be detached from?
This is going
to
transition very well into our next film.
Very good. But I really liked it. And I also thought it was, like Hurt Locker, a strange sort of comparison, but very clever.
Hurt
Locker was not done.
Hurt Locker is the Up of Iraq War movies. No, Hurt Locker and Up both, to my mind, were the best movies because they were very unexpected and very creative and innovative, and you've never seen a movie like this with the same plot.
And I can just say, I mean, Jim basically stole... did you see my notes? I mean, you're right. That first few minutes of Up is tremendous filmmaking, and it really just shows... How can you not, every time Pixar comes out with something, how can you not have, in my mind, a subscription to every Pixar movie?
Exactly.
I go to everything they do because I think they're not only fast, they're beautiful to look at, but they're just great storytellers. And that first 5 or 10 minutes, whatever that is a tremendous, beautiful and concentrated little film, and it sets you up perfectly for the hour and 20 minutes that follows.
And the other thing I thought about, and I'll let Tim talk a little bit. You did see Up.
No,
right?
I didn't.
Oh, you didn't see it. Okay, well, then we won't let you talk.
Don't talk to him.
That first 5 minutes, it's basically, you start with this old grumpy man who's in his house, and it tells you why he's like the way he is. Mm-hmm. And I thought, wouldn't it be great if we were able to see that about every person's life, yeah. that we'd be able to understand, you know, why a person's like the way they are, you know, what makes them tick, but also, you know, what kind of hurts and pains have led them, you know, to sort of be the kind of people they are, and, you know, flawed, limited, sometimes sinful, uncharitable. And, you know, I thought, well, this is sort of the way that God sees us a bit, you know, sees the whole story. And, you know, I just thought it was very touching that way. And then, you know, once the story starts, you have this whole backstory. And really, Ed Asner, the fellow who voices, who I think is one of my favorite actors, who voices the character, doesn't really have to say very much because you know this guy's life. And he only has to say a few words about the whole movie.
That's going to lead us well into the next discussion, which is on Up in the Air. And in terms of questions of detachment and our relationships with other people and with things, the question comes up, what's in your backpack, which comes up in this film. Jim, maybe you can segue into that film.
Yeah, speaking of detachment, it's as most people know by now, it's George Clooney playing a fellow named Ryan Bingham, who is basically someone who's the opposite of a headhunter. He's kind of a head chopper. And he goes from town to town, laying people off at the behest of different corporations. And it's a wonderful morality tale. Our reviewer John McCarthy pointed this out as well for sort of, you know, 2009 or 2010 America. As Tim mentioned, he has a shtick. He's a sort of motivational speaker with a canned talk called "What's in Your Backpack?" And the sort of implication is that very little should be in your backpack. You should live life sort of unencumbered, which at the beginning I thought, well, isn't that wonderful? That's a great Ignatian theme of detachment. But you realize slowly that his life is unencumbered by even personal relationships. And so that what's in your backpack spiel takes a somewhat darker tone. I thought it was a terrific movie. I thought it's Jason Reitman, is it? Who's
yes.
Ivan Reitman's Ghostbusters, son of Ghostbusters director, was just terrific. George Clooney, who I find sometimes coasts on his looks, I thought was well suited to this part. Vera Farmiga was terrific. The young woman, Anna Kendricks, I thought was great. I thought it was very real. And also at the end, I won't give it away, like Hurt Locker, not everything is neatly tied up. I was very surprised at the ending, which I...
I think this will be my... I don't think it will be Best Picture of the Year, but it'll be my choice for Best Picture of the Year. And I think Avatar, just by the way, for the record, will probably win. And everybody should read Hendrik Hertzberg had an interesting article last week about the voting for this year's Oscars.
I didn't read that yet. Okay.
Because basically, the way they're doing the voting, theoretically, a film like Hurt Locker could win because it's I forget what they call, but you should read it. It's in this last week. Okay. The way it works is actually
in the New Yorker last week.
Yeah, yeah. It's my little pretentious little note of the week. I read the.
You
New
call
Yorker.
Him Rick, right?
I also noticed you didn't mention the magazine as if we're all supposed to know Hendrik Hertzberg.
My buddy Rick.
I'm sorry. Exactly. and also I'm a monotheist. I just understand. I agree. It is like a parable to me. And again, it's so appropriate in 2010, the economic climate. I have to admit, I liked the movie a lot, and then I was speaking to Father Ed Salmon, who is the rector here at this community recently, where he had just seen the movie, we were talking about it, and it really brought out to me that what this guy was doing, even though he was a head chopper, right, he was basically downsizing people, and he was not doing it out of the goodness of his heart, and yet there was a sense, really, of it almost being a ministry to him, because it... he realized the human connection was incredibly important. And I don't want to give away anything either, but it is not a movie bereft of hope. And it's not a movie that gives you a placebo either, but it is not a movie bereft of hope in the least. And I agree that George Clooney, who I think is really, really talented, more than I care to admit, you know, because he's like, wow, he's good-looking, rich, and talented, and he makes good choices. Boy, that's... really, you really want to hate.
But he doesn't work for Busted Halo, though.
Exactly.
So
but he did serve a purgatory of like 30 years in sitcoms. So.
Exactly. Right. No, so, but I would say that, you know, while he still kind of plays George Clooney, the story itself and the film itself and what happens to that character and where he goes through and where he ends up and where's a place, where, like you said, where a lot of us end up, which is an unresolved place, but a place where he's moving forward, I would say is a, I think it's a great movie. Just flat out a great movie.
Yeah, I this is the last film I've seen with a new young one in our life. I don't get to see a lot of movies, but this is the one that I knew that I would have to see. And yeah, I mean, I really was, first of all, the ending surprised me because it doesn't end. I mean, as you say, there is hope in this film, but it doesn't tie things up neatly at the end. Yeah, on the question of what are our attachments to other people and, you know, what relationships in our life. Yeah, in a lot of ways, yeah, your family relationships do tie you down to a certain extent, but... you do have obligations outside yourself, and they, they raise that point, I think, in a way that's not too heavy-handed.
No, it's not. I also think what Bill was saying about his ministry, in a sense, of working with those people who are being laid off. I used to work in human resources, mm-hmm. and there's nothing more wrenching, you know, for people than to be fired, of course, in terms of your dignity and, you know, in this culture, you are what you do, and if you're not doing anything, you're nothing. At least that's unfortunately the way some people feel. But he really approached it with this great sense of tenderness and compassion. And I found that I wasn't expecting that going in the movie. And I was really quite touched by that.
Right. And I think we can say, I mean, one of the developments of the film is this young associate played by Anna Kendrick wants to do this by like video conferencing.
Right.
And, you know, Clooney resists. The Ryan Bingham character resists because he feels like you can't do this at arm's length. You need to do it in person. And so even though he's doing a terrible thing, and one way, he's trying to do it with some degree of humanity and compassion.
I also thought it was very interesting that she, the young woman, is kind of the sharky one.
Yeah.
You know, she's the super professional one, which is kind of sort of upends the movie stereotype. Yeah.
Why did I feel, and someone, please correct me if I'm wrong, but there's something almost like a latter-day Cheever quality to this story. I mean, the sense of the kind of the successful businessman who sort of has existential kind of angst. There's something of just a short story quality about it that if I had read this in a short story.
Well, it's a novel. Collection. Walter Kern, very well-respected novelist. And
it's also like The Swimmer. Remember the Cheever short story?
Yeah, exactly.
The Swimmer,
that's
where
exactly
there's a sense of movement. He's not really getting anywhere.
He's swimming in people's backyards in Westchester back
home.
Right.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point. It is, I mean, Cheever talked about that kind of sense of anomie and isolation. And, and he's literally isolated, you know, 30,000 feet above. That's a good The last 2 years you asked us what we think will win and should win.
And I think Bill has already said that he thinks...
I jumped the gun on that.
Up in the Air should win, and he thinks Avatar will actually win. Jim, why don't you weigh in?
I think Avatar will win just because of the sort of money it's brought in. I think that generally is what happens in the Academy Awards. And I think Up in the Air should win.
Okay. Yeah. Well, just to go against the grain here a bit, I think...
That's good because Jim saw two movies, so that's...
I think Hurt Locker should win. Okay. And I guess part of me really hopes that it will win, but maybe to be realistic, I think Avatar is going to pull it out. Mm-hmm.
And how much of this is really, in some ways, about putting 10 movies on there, about the Oscars just promoting movies, which I guess it's supposed to do to a certain degree, but it's really like... It's creating energy and interest where there might not be.
Sure, I mean, I might actually watch The Blind Side now.
Exactly.
Well, and they said earlier, I mean, years and years ago, that they actually had 10, and they were very explicit about, you know, wanting to bring in new people, to sort of... And in fact, you know, when a movie, you know, as Tim was saying, gets an Academy Award nomination, you're much more likely to go and see it. I actually would see Blind Side because it got nominated, whereas before I thought it was more of a sort of... You know, Lifetime Movie Network Award.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm going to sort of sit up and take notice.
Well, we want to thank Father Jim Martin, culture editor here at America, and Bill McGarvey, as always, for coming in for the third round.
Did I win again?
We'll see.
I win each one of these, right?
I'm sure you will pronounce as much on your website.
But even if you didn't win.
My father, let me just say this, my father was offended at that last year.
Oh, was he?
He said, I thought you were a little bit too much on the Weisenheimer stuff from last year.
The first time he said that. Well,
exactly.
Both of you.
Now he's doubly offended.
Well, thanks a lot, and we'll hope to see you next year.
All right.
See you then.
Bye-bye.